My name is Cheryl Langdon Orr, and this is the CCWD Stress Test Working Party call for the 3rd of June 2015. In fact, it might be the 2nd of June in the rest of the world, but for me it's already the 3rd in the Antipodes. We have a carryover agenda from last week's call ahead of us today, where we're going to look at a rewrite based on a hypothetical that Chris Despain, CEO of the .au CCTLD operation in Australia, put towards the list. And Steve Del Bianco has been kind enough to take the specifics within that particularly outlined and staged hypothetical that the list discussed, and creating a particular stress test, and I'll pass it on to Stephen in just a moment to go through that. But what also needs to be noted is that we're at a point with the discussions and deliberations and the input from our public comments starting to come in, that there is a need to identify and articulate some additional stress tests. So as far as I know from Steve, we have one that has been proposed from Mateo, one of our co-chairs, and one from Avery. And I don't see Avery on the call, but perhaps she will be joining us shortly. So we will also get to that as part of our, or those, I should say, as part of our agenda for today. So with that very brief introduction, we have a document up on the screen which articulates the linkage materials and activities between last week's call and this week's call, and I'm going to hand over to Steve. Steve, over to you.
Hey, good morning, Cheryl. And Aubrey was with us a moment ago on Adobe, but she fell off. Maybe she'll get back on. I hope so. So, Cheryl, you want to start with what's on Adobe now, which is the framing of two additional stress tests or scenarios that arose from Chris Despain's initial. So you have control of the Adobe. If you scroll to the bottom, you'll see Chris Despain's original note from May the 21st, where he laid out a seven-step scenario wherein he feared that, hey, good morning, Aubrey, I'm glad you're back on. Aubrey, we're just quickly checking what's in the Adobe, which is the way I reframed Chris Despain's stress test. This is a follow-up to last week's call, and I wanted to walk through that a little bit because when I did that work later in the day, I sent it around to each of you, waited 24 hours, didn't hear back, and said, okay, I guess that's a go signal, and then I did send it to Chris Despain, and then I can follow up that he and I talked over the weekend too, so I can sort of bring us all up to speed on that. So I think it was a completely worthwhile exercise because in Chris's scenario, which is at the bottom of what's in Adobe, the scenario would have a court, a California court, interpreting the meaning of ICANN's mission statement and core values, and potentially issuing decisions about interpreting ICANN's mission statement and bylaws. I'll be the first to admit that's a frightening prospect. I don't think that's at all what we are intending to have happen. I don't know that we can ever prevent that under any mechanism or structure. It probably could happen today. I don't know. But we didn't want to set up something where the expectation was an aggrieved party or the community itself would end up going into court to interpret the bylaws. So we reframed it based on a discussion that the four or five of us had last Wednesday. So if you go back to the top, we made it into two stress tests. The first one is more fitting in with what Chris came up with, and the second one is more along the lines of what Jonathan Zook said at the end of the call. All right, so the first one, the good news, is if the board refused to follow a community recommendation, and we used it as an example, this is near and dear to Aubrey's heart, the ATRT came up with recommending a new policy for implementation. Now, sometimes that requires a PDP, but there are times that an ATRT recommendation doesn't require a PDP. It can be implemented, such as a new procedure at ICANN, a new bylaw change that the board would then put forth. But in this case, what Chris said is that the board decides to reject the recommendation on the grounds that it conflicts with ICANN's limited mission statement. And our working group is proposing that it be even more tightly limited after the transition than it is today. Oh, sorry. Aubrey's not hearing. Cheryl, can you hear me?
I can indeed, loud and clear.
That's good, because if nobody was hearing me, I would have to start over. Sorry. Okay, so Aubrey has to dial back in. Okay. So, Cheryl, cut in any time. Same for you, Power. If you spot anything in this set of four steps, please intervene. But these four steps indicate that the community members could challenge the board's decision with an IRP, not a court. And the IRP are international arbitration experts. They're not U.S. judges. And all they can do is negate the decision. They do not give the members or the IRP panel the ability to tell ICANN to do something specific. All the IRP panel can do is either confirm or kill the decision that the board made. So given that, it's not in court at this point. It's strictly with the arbitrators. If the arbitrators come back and give us a clear step saying that the board's decision should be set aside, and then the board refuses to actually implement the ATRT recommendation, which is in step one above, we have a recourse. I guess we could recall the board, which is rather dramatic. We could also block the budget for the very next year or the strat plan for the next year if it failed to include funding for that ATRT recommendation. That doesn't actually solve our problem in the sense of a change that requires no expenditures, right? So a change to the bylaw that didn't have any expenditures that came out of an ATRT recommendation, we wouldn't be able to block the budget, hold the budget hostage until it was added. So we wouldn't have much to go on there except this. You could go to court to force ICANN to follow the decision. But the decision was simply to set aside the board's refusal to implement. So I don't understand how a court gets involved at all in the first scenario. And when I sent this to Chris, he called me over the weekend and understood that we had a good point. He had some other points to make, though, that I'll go through with you. The second stress test is the one that Jonathan Zook has sort of put a twist on it, where the board actually follows the community recommendation, but later is reversed by an IRP. So it's the same example where the ATRT came up with a recommendation. The board decides to accept it, thinking that it's fine. It's not inconsistent with the mission statement. It came from the community. But then someone in the community, like an aggrieved party or potentially the whole community, has second thoughts and challenges the board's decision with an IRP. And again, the IRP has standard of review, substantive limitations on the permissible scope, and the IRP could cancel the board's decision to implement that recommendation. And then if the board ignored the ruling and continued to implement, well, then the board would be ignoring the IRP decision, right? So if it did, we have the ability to recall the board, but we could also block the next decision. And in all cases, we could go to a California court and enforce the IRP recommendation, because the courts of any country that accept international arbitration results are presumably empowered to take an IRP panel recommendation and force its implementation. I don't know the legal steps as to how that happens. Presumably the court would look at whether all the steps were followed by the IRP, whether all the information was appropriate, and they would say, look, this is an IRP, we need to enforce this, and they'd create some injunction and serve it upon ICANN. So in neither of these cases is the court involved in interpreting ICANN's bylaws and mission statement. It's It's simply enforcing an IRP decision as a result of arbitration. So I'll stop there. Cheryl, Avery, Per, what are your thoughts about the way we rephrased all this, and are we on the right track? Cheryl, when I didn't hear back for about 24 hours last week, was I correct to interpret that to be consent that we had this right?
Well, I think it's consent.
I think you were in the middle of a goddaughter being born, right?
My granddaughter, actually, yes. So I think it's consent for us to write up and run it through as a stress test. There may be some nuances that needs to still be discussed, and there may indeed be other stress tests which come out of the woodwork as we work in this next couple of weeks. Avery, are you now, can I just get you to confirm that you are now fully connected with audio?
I guess so.
Yes, and we can hear you, but I'm disappointed to see the PARS having sound issues as well, but he does have to go off to another meeting. Okay. With this particular stress test, the first one, and to a lesser extent, I suppose, the second one, we have not as yet put it into our tabular form, and I guess we should be looking towards doing that, assuming that we all agree that this does become, I think, 27 and 28 of our stress tests published on the wiki. Is there anybody who wishes to speak to, embellish, follow through and do any update that they weren't able to make during the call for input that Steve made last week? If you'd like to make yourselves known and your opinion known now, that would be a good time to do so. And that's resounding silence,
Cheryl,
Steve. So I guess the answer to your question is yes.
Yeah. So, Cheryl, Chris Despain called me over the weekend, and he acknowledged that perhaps maybe he had misstated his original seven-step process in light of what the IRP actually does. And he appreciated the work we put in to reframing it these two ways, and acknowledge that a court would not relitigate. And that's good. So Chris acknowledged that. So I think that we could move these into table form. But while I was on the phone with Chris, what he did was try to surface what he called his underlying concern. And his underlying concern was he suspects that the creation of members would somehow give extra standing to go to court directly and bypass things like the IRP. And that's not the scenario he had originally come up with, but it's certainly one that's worth exploring. But before we turn to Chris's underlying concern, I wanted to be sure that Avery was comfortable with the two new stress tests that we proposed and that I wrote up after last Tuesday's call, because I know that you weren't on the audio bridge earlier, Avery. So, Avery, are you comfortable with the way these two four-step programs, or five, four- and five-step stress tests are looking?
Yeah, I was actually just reading them now. I apologize for not having read them before the meeting. I guess I find it interesting that now we have people voting. I think it's funny that now post court we're voting people out, as opposed to court being the last step. If I'm reading it correctly, we're actually putting court as a middle step ourselves.
I don't think you read that right.
If they go to court, then and we don't follow what the court said, if the board member continues to ignore and the court orders to enforce it, members could vote to recall. So the court orders to enforce it, but indeed, what would the court do to enforce it? People would say, okay, thank you, court. Booze, I'm not going to do it. And then somebody has to take them back to court.
I understand.
It's actually funny. What we're doing, and I think Chris is right, what we're doing is making court one of our tools. And we will use it anywhere.
I think it's the opposite, and Chris will back me up on this, Aubrey. Chris acknowledged as much. There is no court in step three. Step three is the IRP. And if the IRP comes back with a decision, the way the IRP works, if you looked at page 32 of the proposal, is that any court that recognizes international arbitration results can give an order to implement the decision of the arbitrators. That's all that the court does. And the court only does that if, in this case, ICANN refused to do what the arbitrators instructed it to do. So there is no court in step three, no court at all in step three. In step four, what I laid out was, well, what do we do if the board continued to refuse this ATRT recommendation that the arbitrators said, ICANN, you were wrong to refuse. You were wrong to reject it, which doesn't force the board to implement it. Your says says you're wrong to reject it. At that point, you know, we're befuddled. We have a board who rejected our recommendation, wouldn't put it in. The IRP said the board is wrong not to put it in. We only have a few tools in our arsenal at that point, but they are court enforceable if we become a member organization, right? We could recall the board, and the court helps enforce that if the board doesn't step down. You could block the next budget or strat plan if it failed to include the recommendation from the ATRT, and a court could enforce that budget block. And
how?
I understand from many lawyers. Go ahead.
I've gotten curious. How do the courts enforce this? They give a judgment. And then what happens if the judgment is not followed?
Yeah, well, I'm not a lawyer either, but when you get an injunction, I thought an injunction was enforceable. I thought that...
Only by dragging you into jail or fining you millions of dollars. But, of course, fining you millions of dollars doesn't work since we're the ones to pay the dollars in the end. It's all very interesting. Yes, your stress test follows through logically.
And it avoids what Chris was fearing the most, which was having a court interpret. Wow, look at this ATRT recommendation. Let me go interpret it against the mission statement in the bylaws. The court never looks at that. The independent review panel does. And all the court can do is evaluate whether or not the international arbitrator's result was properly constructed so that they can be put in. Oh, there's the snoring again.
I think it's a wonderful comment on this whole. I wish I was doing that at the moment.
Yeah, that's come up on a few other Adobe calls, so I'm pretty sure it's not snoring. It's something else, but it is pretty.
It's actually, sadly, my beasts. my microphone picks up extraordinarily well, so I have to mute and I fail to. My apologies for the background noise of the Fur family. Okay. So, Steve, it looks to me like we've got additions to our Section 4.
All right, and we can write those up. And as I was saying earlier, Chris would like to spawn another one that Becky and I are working on now, which is this notion that I don't even know if it's a stress test. Chris hasn't posed it as a stress test. He said, okay, so my underlying question was, what prevents – have we really turned loose some new power where a community member, an ACSO, could go directly to court and bypass the IRP? Well, Becky Burr jumped on that, did a bunch of research, and discussed an awful lot of it on yesterday's call in the slides that she put up at the end of the call. And those slides would show that use of an IRP can be a binding part of the member relationship with ICANN. So if Becky has properly addressed that there, I don't think there is a stress test, and nobody has asked us to do one on that. I'm just giving you a heads up that that was really at the core of Chris's concern, and he concedes that if you follow these steps the way that the process is designed, we don't have a court risk in these two sets of stress tests.
Okay. There was, however, out of today's earlier today's call, one if not two suggestions for stress tests, and I believe, Steve, you were able to capture some proposed wording for those, which would be our, we're heading towards 30, aren't we, 29 and 30 in our stress test numbering?
I think so.
And this is symbolic of a problem I think we have. But I don't think it's the stress test group's problem. I think it's the solutions problem. All I can compare it to is the way I pack a truck, which is very badly. And then I have to tie off everything. And then I notice something moves, and I add another rope. And then I notice something moves, and I add another rope. And finally, I've got a connection of ropes inside the truck that my friends have called early spider web. And I think that's what we're doing. You know, Becky, somebody notices, oh, my God, they could take things to court halfway through the process and not follow the process. Oh, okay, let's add another rule. And it's that membership is looking like it only works if we keep adding rules to it to constrain it. And I just get more and more convinced as we get more and more stress tests to prove that the tie-offs really work, that we have an unworkable solution. But that's not the stress test team's problem.
So, Aubrey, I'd love to know, can you give me another example of a tie-off, a couple of more, so I have a better understanding of what you're thinking?
Yeah.
I think we've seen them all the way through in this process that you know, oh, okay, a UA doesn't really work. Well, we'll create this legal binding in this document that if it doesn't work, we'll go to court. And so that was another one that's come up recently. I think if you look back at the solutions all the way through, it's membership. Well, membership doesn't quite work, but if we do this and we add that and hey, you know, I'm not a member. I'm just looking for the accountability holes. So I will just remain amused.
Cheryl here. I think it's fairly important that we do explore that. I mean, in many ways, I'd be happy to have more numerous articulations of hypotheticals that will at least give us and the wider community on review some solace that we've looked at the what if and maybes for all these belts and braces and ropes and things that you've described.
I think you have. I think the stress team's done a fine job of looking at them all.
But do you feel we should draw a line somehow and say, and now this is enough, or do we remain as I think?
No, I don't think there'll ever be enough.
Open for additional.
I don't think there'll ever be enough. I think we'll be keep adding one until the decision is signed and sealed. We'll keep adding new stress tests.
Okay, and you're comfortable with that as an outcome from a stress test working party point of view that we are leaving our list open, albeit with fairly high bars to entry for additional stress tests?
Yes. I think the constant need for new ones is a bad sign, but I'm comfortable with the stress test team doing it.
Thank you. I think that's important for us to have on the record.
I note
that there's been a number of, that should be a stress test comments. But nothing specific has been articulated, and we probably need to start ensuring between the Buenos Aires meeting and Dublin that when someone says, oh, shouldn't that be a stress test, the response is, fine, articulate the specifics, give it to us, and we will look at it. Jonathan,
Cheryl,
I may have heard Jonathan, but if not, back to you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you. And good morning, Jonathan. I think you just joined us. Aubrey, with respect to the tie-offs, what comes to mind is that we all designed, and I think you were the leader of a couple of tie-offs that we did early on. They have nothing to do with membership, right? But the tie-off that says, well, what if I can't quit the affirmation of commitments? Well, the tie-off there was to move the commitments and the reviews into the bylaws. So many of these tie-offs, we are very proud of the fact that we came up with them.
I would have put those more as solutions to originally posed problems, but okay.
Okay. Another one is that in order for the IRP to work, we had to have a decision we could challenge. So we went to 9.1 of ATRT2 and said that the board has to act on, take a decision on, formal advice of an AC. And I think that was another great tie-off that allowed us to solve the contingency that the board simply took no action, so we couldn't challenge an IRP on that case. So there are a lot of ways in which the stress tests have surfaced the need to go plug a hole or tie off a piece of stuff that's going to fall off the truck. Jonathan, you probably don't even know what we're talking about, but Aubrey used the metaphor of tying on a bunch of luggage onto a truck and how things are shifting and poking out here and there, and you're constantly tying off pieces to keep them there, and you end up looking like a giant spider web at the end, and that's not an optimal outcome. So I asked Aubrey for other examples, and the two she has so far that feel like tie-offs that aren't helpful are unincorporated associations becoming unaccountable might result in going to court, and that if a member yesterday's call where Becky said we could write the bylaws such that members, after you go to an IRP first, they can't go directly to court.
Mm.
And Aubrey said this is indicative of the problem with our solutions. If we have to keep doing tie-offs to avoid becoming an overly court-driven or an overly litigation-driven system. So I know it's not exactly on point to the stress test, but I'm anxious to hear more about what's behind that, because inevitably we are going to discover through stress tests or other means ways in which there are holes in our solutions, and plugging a hole, I think, is a good thing. It's not indicative that our solution is inferior. It might still be the best available solution we have, but that doesn't make it perfect. We have to do our best to try to make it so that it really will work in a real-world situation.
Yeah, I guess this is Aubrey. I guess it's that the difference between an engineering approach and a legal approach, but you're right.
Right, and I'm an engineer too, and if I'm tying stuff over and over again, at some point I say, this is crazy, I need to start over and repack the truck. That's my view, or get a different truck. So I'm all over that, but there's no way that I believe that the tie-offs that we've done indicate an instability in the underlying packing. Quite the contrary. Most of the concerns and questions that are raised, I believe, are like Chris's. They revealed a misunderstanding of the mechanisms. And in this case, Chris's reaction to our reframed stress test proves my point, is that the tie-off he thought we needed, the crisis he thought he identified, isn't really there. In fact, it works really well. Okay. I guess we'll move on. Cheryl, I have another stress test that Matthew put in, and then we wanted to go to – Matthew's is a quick one, and then I wanted to return
to the one that Aubrey brought up
yesterday. Okay.
Yeah,
in the chat, I just posted a note that Matthew sent over. He says, you may think I am obsessed with recent news, but with the recent spotlight on the FIFA scandals, I think we can reasonably expect questions regarding how our proposed measures would avoid such a situation. So I think the first step is to see whether we have covered corruption in the stress test that we've designed. So I'm sure each of you are reaching into your bags and pulling out your handy-dandy copy of our stress tests. I'm going through mine right now because I'm pretty sure we had one on corruption or fraud. It's on page 70.
Yep.
Page 70, paragraph 439. So many thanks to Alice, Adam, and Kim for going directly to that page. Thank you very much. So it's on the Adobe in front of you.
They're psychic. They're definitely psychic, Steve.
I know. I don't even know how they knew this was coming. So on this one, we said that it was Sam Eisner who helped us on the middle column. You know, we wrote this quite a while ago, and this tracks pretty closely to the FIFA scandal. It's interesting to note.
Yeah.
Oh, somebody scrolled it. There you go. Stay there. So in the middle column, Sam helped us to say that ICANN already had annual audit that might identify whether people were siphoning money off, which is exactly what happened in FIFA. ICANN has an anonymous hotline if an employee knew about it and could call it in. And if something like that happened, the board can fire the CEO or the executives responsible. And finally, she acknowledged that the community has no ability to force the board to take action against suspected corruption or fraud. So on the middle column, and the part of our stress testing was to ask whether existing accountability measures are adequate. And then the next column was on the proposed measures, we could force the board to consider a recommendation arising from an ATRT or affirmation of commitments review, which is really where an ATRT would come in. They would make recommendations that would safeguard against fraud in the future, something like that. And also the community could veto the budget if we felt that was a place where corruption was occurring in the way that the community's money was being spent. And then finally, in the lower right-hand corner, if the board itself was involved in the corruption, or if they didn't act decisively, one proposed measure lets us remove individual directors and recall the entire board. So I'll go out on a limb and say I would love to reply to Matthew and say good news. It's as if we anticipated the FIFA scandal. Look at stress test number 9 on page 70. What do others think?
The queue's open. Jonathan, go ahead. Oh, Jonathan's agreeing. Did you want to say something, Jonathan?
No, I mean, I think it is pretty well covered, and we've been talking about FIFA since long before this piece of thing boiled over. That's been the metaphor that we've used to hear quite a bit, so I think that's why some of this made it in.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Avery, did I hear your voice?
No, actually, you didn't hear my voice. However, as I wrote in the chat, since there's no reason to believe that step 442 works, and since the board has to date, as far as I could tell, ignored ATRT 2 solutions, recommendations, that there needed to be a serious review of this whole process, because a process that had existed for this many years and never reported anything was somehow suspect, not to mention the work that the ATRT did in talking to people to find out if they would ever use it and the answers we got. If we're depending on step 442 as critical to this whole process, then, yeah, it reads quite well. Whether it would actually work or not is another question. Thank you.
Thanks, Avery. So it seems to me, Steve, that at least with the group on this stress test call, we can in fact get back to Matthias with that information that says Nine has got it covered. Jonathan, your hand's raised. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, all I was going to say is that I think what Avery spoke to is exactly why we have 445, is the ability to have this check and balance, that if 442 doesn't work as currently implemented, there's the ability of the community now to, you know, be a little more persuasive about ATRT recommendations and other things, so that that balance exists and the ability to improve those mechanisms exists, yeah, under the proposed framework.
Thanks, Jonathan. Back to you, Steve.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Yeah, I appreciate that Jonathan pointed that out. It shows that the existing accountability measures, you know, per Aubrey's point, are probably not adequate if they're ignored. And when Jonathan points out that 445 is specifically designed to go to an IRP in the case where the board is ignoring an ATRT recommendation like 442, I'm still left with very little comfort if it's not enforceable. If we do an IRP and the board continues to ignore it, yes, you know what? And we may need to spill the board or go to court and force the implementation of an IRP decision. So I honestly think that enforceability ends up coming out of this. So if I replied to Matthew, I'll indicate that page 70, stress test 9, is almost as if it anticipated the FIFA scandal. I'll indicate that one of the existing accountability measures in 442, and Aubrey, I don't know that I can say for sure that it's not working. All I can say is, do we suspect that the anonymous hotline has not been implemented? Do we have any evidence to indicate they've ignored the ATRT recommendations?
This is Aubrey. I didn't put my hand up. As far as we can tell, the review that was required, which had to be done somewhat transparently of the process, as far as I can tell, has not been done. But it's so early. They might be still thinking about it. It could happen.
Like 9.1, right? They're still thinking about it. So I don't think I'll make any accusations that it hasn't been done.
No. And I'm not saying, I'm just saying, I believe 442 is the weak point in the existing measures. But, of course, it's a weak point that means we probably won't know about it unless we have our own, you know, Eric Snowden at some point. We just wouldn't know. Without someone to tell you it's happening, you don't get to the next steps. But, hey.
Right. And I don't love waiting every 3 years or 4 years or 5 years for an ATRT, but the next ATRT, and I hope you'll be on it, I mean, one of the things they do is they dive into previous recommendations, see if they've been implemented. You could turn to staff and say, give us a report on all the times the employee hotline has been dialed, how many times has it been used, what's been the disposition. So we can surface the information, but it only happens once every 3 to 4 years when we do an ATRT. And that's better than nothing, but it's not.
Just that, you know, this recommendation about having a proper whistleblower mechanism, which they're not even willing to call it that, but calling it a hotline because, well, whistleblower means there's something to whistleblow about, has been a recommendation since long before the ATRT too. And what was put in was the hotline, and you know, it comes up most ATRTs, and I'm sure it will continue to until there's a good whistleblower mechanism for staff.
And Aubrey, if the next ATRT looks and says we want to know the information on how many times it's being used and what was the disposition, and if staff turns around and says that's confidential, well, you and I wrote some really tough transparency requirements into the recommendations. It's another tie-off, if you will, where ATRT and all the affirmation review teams would have access to internal documents. So that would become part of the bylaws, and we'd have a much better chance of getting access to the internal information. Adam Peake, you just put something in the chat. Well, that's helpful, Adam, to know that it's being advertised to the employees that are designed to use it, and that's good. You're going to send us pictures. Okay, great. And, Adam, do you happen to know whether it's ever been used? That's just a yes, no. You don't have to betray any confidences.
Adam, just speak up. Oh, no. Oh, doesn't matter. Okay.
Okay. So, Aubrey, we'll just suggest that hypothetically, for instance, if any of these have not been implemented or are not being used, we turn to 445. And for 445 to be effective, it's got to be enforceable. All right. I want to give Adam a chance to finish his typing. He's giving us some hotline information. Any more from that from you, Adam, or should we move on?
Moving on then, Steve.
Okay. So I will reply to Matthew with a reference to page 70. I'll probably include it right in the body of the email and walk through this notion of, for instance, ATR T2 recommendation on hotline. If it were not being followed, 445 allows us to go to an IRP, and if ICANN still ignored it, we could turn to a court to enforce it if we use the member structure. All right. The next one, Aubrey, I was hoping to turn to you because on the last two calls of the CCWG, Alan Greenberg and I've heard you mention it as well, maybe even Robin, will say, well, how do we make sure that the UA, the unincorporated association individuals, follow the underlying ACNSO, or in the case of, say, ALAC, who may doesn't want to do a UA, or the GAC doesn't want to do a UA, they just have their chair carry all five votes. I keep hearing people say, well, what if the person who carries the votes doesn't follow the underlying ACNSO? And when people say that, they often say it definitively, as if this is dispositive. This shows that the model doesn't work. But this doesn't really have anything to do with the member structure. The same thing would be true under a designator. It would even be true under a cross-community working group, which is what the BC, in my case, what I proposed a year ago, a permanent cross-community working group. I have since given that up since it's not enforceable. But if we were to return to that, we always will have the problem that our representative, the one who carries our votes, doesn't follow the directed instructions of the underlying ACNSO. And if that were to happen, we need another tie-off. Jordan has often, I think I gave Jordan credit for this from the Singapore meeting, where he said that if let's say, the CCNSO, the person carrying the five CCNSO votes did not vote according to what CCNSO came up with, the CCNSO, someone in the CCNSO, presumably an officer, would inform the other members of the community and ICANN Legal that these votes were improperly cast. And I think what Jordan had said is that that would negate the vote that was just taken and gives the CCNSO in that case time to replace the person voting with someone who will follow the instructions, and then you redo the ballot. That was just one tie-off for that. And notice that doesn't require going to court. Let me just open the queue as to whether I'm articulating the problem the right way, and should we turn this into a stress test? Aubrey?
Hi. Yeah, thanks. Okay. So if the SOAC, if the SO, if the CCNSO were the UA, I think what Jordan is saying would be true. The problem is that we are not taking the approach of turning each of the SOs and ACs into UAs. What we are doing is associating a UA with each of them
with a very complicated articles of incorporation that seem to, on one hand, still leave the definition of what the SO is up to the ICANN board, and yet somehow at the same time declare them an independent legal agent. This is one time when not being a lawyer has really injured me. I have read that articles of incorporation many times, and it gets me twisted. But the point is that the association between the SO and the AC is not one of them being the same thing, but one of them of having a legal relationship between them. So, at a certain point, it's the UA that is a member, not the SO. And the SO has a tangential control over the UA. I don't know that the SO has standing to go to, you know, the membership, the ICANN board, the ICANN legal, and actually make a claim saying that the UA did the wrong thing. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Again, it's defined as a legal relationship. It's not an identity relationship. And so the only place that you might be able to enforce that is court. Anytime you put a legal instrument in as the connection point, what you are saying is, and we go to court if it doesn't work out. Otherwise, why do you have a legal relationship? So that's where I see the possible accountability gap. As I said, if we were talking about membership or each of the SOs, and if you read Sidley's work, you'll see that they do differentiate between these shadow-related UAs and the notion of identity. And they built a very careful, as I said, they do what they think we're instructing. They did a very careful creation of an articles of incorporation that seemed to match our demand for the SOs to still be controlled by the board and yet somehow be independent enough to qualify as UAs. That is what I think is broken in our membership model at the moment. And my objection to the membership model is more that piece of breakage than the membership model itself. So that's what I personally see. The accountability gap. I can't speak for Robin or Alan.
Helps if you come off mute before you get heard. Thanks for that, Avery. Steve, back to you.
Thanks, Avery. I was about to dive into the this notion of standing, about sending a note to ICANN Legal saying, if I'm the chair of the CCNSO and I send a note to Legal saying, our rep, our designee, our voter did not vote according to the constituency. I don't think that's a matter of standing. As you know, anybody can send an email to the general counsel of ICANN. And we haven't said in the bylaws who it is that supervises the voting of the members, the voting of a cross-community working group. We'll need to have that in any event. But let me set that aside for a moment, because I was really intrigued by what you said, because maybe you're getting to the nub of the problem here, where you said this is what's really broken in the membership model, and it has to do with the shadow UA versus the identity of the underlying ACSO. And then I heard you use a phrase where the board controls the ACSO. And so I would... Cheryl, if it's okay with you, I'd like to give Avery a chance to unpack that a little bit more for me, because I didn't quite pick it all up. Because if this is really the nub of your concern over the membership model, this is where what's broken about membership, I just want to be sure I understand it really thoroughly. So, Avery, if you just indulge me, tell me again that the core problem that you think is broken in the membership model.
Okay. The SOs and ACs currently are defined and controlled by the bylaws. And any changes in them, we go through a review every couple years from the board. It's part of our whole internal
accountability cycle where the board is allegedly accountable to us and our structures are accountable to the board. And every 3 years or 5 years, there's a review. The SIC sits and thinks about it for a while. And then, as we saw with the GNSO, makes a bunch of pronouncements on how we should change our organizations to make them better. Or at least that's the impact. And that loop has been critical to people. Now, the notion of a UA is that it is an independent person. It is an independent associated person. I mean, it's an aggregate person, not a natural person, but it is an independent actor. And somehow, now, if the SO, and this is discussed in Sidley's report, if the SO were to stop being as susceptible to the board and become a UA as an independent organization, remove its bylaws and its definition from ICANN's hands and put it completely in its own hands, like most membership organizations do. You know, most UAs define for themselves who they are in a bottom-up manner. And we obviously know that that's not the case in the GNSO. It's not the case in at-large ALAC, where they're dependent on MOUs and other definitions that come from the board, et cetera. So none of these SOs or ACs are independent entities. But UAs are independent entities. To become members of an organization, they can't be part of that organization. So they have to be standing outside the organization. So what the model that Sidley creates for us, given that duality of we want something that can be a member, but we also want the SOAC to be defined by ICANN. And those two don't go together.
Aubrey, if I can interrupt.
Yeah.
Okay, really quick interruption. Section 2 of the screen in front of you, I would have thought exactly answers your question, because it still says that the UA, the association, is completely bound by the rights established by the bylaws of ICANN. So Section 2 says the UA is just an entity fulfilling what the bylaws say was the ACSO. It just gives it a legal personhood. I don't know how that distances or separates it from the bylaws when, in fact, it binds it to the bylaws in Section 2.
Right, and this is a new artifact that we've seen, which, as I said, confuses me, because this takes that separation, which I thought had to exist. But, yeah, you're right. I'm probably wrong, and we should forget about it.
Please don't.
No, as I say, I do not understand this draft example. I do not understand how it solves the problem. And so, you know, I'm quite possibly wrong. Quite possibly solves the problem. I accept that.
Your tone of voice tells me maybe you don't. And I'm being sincere. I want to understand it better. I may not be able to solve your problem. Nobody may. I don't know for sure. But if Section 2, I mean, because I don't understand the UAs either. I'd never heard about it until now. And then I got the sense that it creates legal personhood as opposed to individuals. Okay, so I understand what a legal person is versus a natural person. We went through all that with who is. So I understood that. And I said, okay, so the GNSO is now a legal entity. It's not just the chair of the GNSO. So I kind of got that. And now, up to a minute ago, I was completely on board with you that it would be bad if that entity suddenly unlinked itself from the bylaws to control it and the feedback loop of structural reviews. I get all that, and you're exactly right. But it's possible that Sidley tried specifically to not allow that. And I don't know if I would call this a tie-off. It might have been their design all along, was that the UA has no independent mind. No independent mind at all. The UA is what the bylaws say the ACNSO is, but it just gives it a registration as a legal entity. So that
what
it may
enforces
exercise
that?
Powers.
Okay, what great. Enforces that?
Okay, so what enforces, give me an example.
What enforces this Section 2? What makes it real other than the fact that it's in the articles? And Jonathan has his hand up, so he may have the answer. But
I don't see what enforces it other than court.
Jonathan? So, Aubrey, when you say enforce, yeah, Jonathan, are you speaking?
It looks like his microphone's making noise.
Let's see if we can hear him snoring. No, I don't even hear that. Well, while we're waiting for Jonathan, while we're waiting for that, so Aubrey, we've come full circle. Section 2 would seem to obviate the problem, but you ask a question. In any entity, what makes its articles of incorporation enforceable? Any article, not just Section 2. Ironically, it's sort of like what makes the commitment to go to independent review instead of court. What makes binding arbitration enforceable? And my guess is that if a company knows, if a person understands that they're bound by an article, then sure, they could ignore it, but they ignore it knowing that the other side of the transaction, the underlying members, could immediately go to court and obtain an injunction for the action that's at hand. The injunction could be removal. It could be instructing somebody to vote a certain way. But none of that would be necessary, since if an individual chose to ignore the underlying ACNSO, the ACNSO can remove the individual who carries the votes. Because the CCNSO, if it formed a UA, the CCNSO, it wouldn't go out and find new people to come in and populate that. It'd be the chair and vice chair of the chair of the CCNSO would carry the five votes. He would cast them as the CCNSO unincorporated association. But there aren't really new individuals who suddenly take control of the UA and put themselves in a position of ignoring the articles of incorporation or ignoring the will of the ACNSO that they're part of. That's the separation I haven't seen yet. Jonathan, are you with us? You had your hand up, but you're still on mute.
If he's using the Adobe Connect to try and speak, that's what I couldn't do before, so perhaps he's just fallen into the same problem I did, and that made me call in.
Yeah, and I dialed into the bridge today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, could be a gremlin because I saw an odd sort of a speaker/microphone image there as well. Cheryl, for the record, but he does say in the chat that doesn't mean anyone wants to go to court, nor that it is likely, but it's there to provide the underlying authority. I don't know of an alternative.
I mean, the same is true of ICANN. ICANN has articles of incorporation. Let's just leave aside members, pretend they never existed. We have a corporation that has articles and bylaws, and if it ignores any of them, we don't have much recourse today, but we will if we can challenge the board's decision to an IRP. The IRP compares what the board did to the bylaws, finds that the board's decision was wrong and negates the decision. And then I'm left with exactly Aubrey's question. What if the board ignores the IRP? And when that happens, that's just like the UA ignoring the underlying ACSO. If they don't, they have to understand that that action, ignoring the action of what's in their bylaws, is can lead to a very quick day in court, and they're going to be forced to comply. And that reality is supposed to make it so that they follow their articles of incorporation. But I don't think we're inventing a new problem. As a stress test team, though, our job is usually to come up with a scenario, and that's why I couched it in terms of, I call it a Jordan's scenario, this notion that the person who carries the five votes for the CCNSO has a brain fart and doesn't even follow the instructions he was given by the constituency. You know, they go through a whole process of figuring out how they're going to vote their five votes on blocking a bylaws change, and they vote in a different way. So we need a lot of transparency. How did the CCNSO cast its votes? That has to be transparent. And if it's apparently not what the CCNSO asked for, then anyone in the CCNSO could inform the community at large, and ICANN Legal in particular, that was an invalid vote. In the first instance, you want to make sure that the vote doesn't take effect. The vote gets negated because it was an invalid vote. Okay, great. Set it aside. In the second instance, you have to fix that problem in the CCNSO. You have to fix that problem because whoever carried your votes either didn't get the memo or acted rogue, and you need to fix that. When you fix it, we'll do the vote again. So that's a scenario. That's a way a stress test team would typically write stuff up. And in that process, I don't know that a court is involved at all in what I just laid out, fixing a rogue voter. So, Cheryl, what are your thoughts? Do we start to – what can we write up in a scenario? And there may be more than one.
Yes, I was talking while I was on mute. Sorry about that, Steve. Cheryl, for the record. I think there possibly is more than one here, but I just wanted to note that Jonathan, with the gremlins in the system at the moment for the using the Adobe Connect audio, also says probably no one, because the court is so limited in its powers in this case, they are not fined as a fact. And he also notes he's going to get a call out. Avery, you have your hand raised. Go ahead.
I don't think we need an extra stress test. I think, you know, it would terminate where they all do. Yeah, you go to court. So I think it's fine. I think, you know, the U.S. California courts, which are the new arbiters for the multi-stakeholder model at ICANN, are the ones that would solve this problem as well. So you're right. There is no problem that needs a stress test.
Thank you, Avery.
Avery, come on.
Sorry, for the record. No, I'm giggling, but I also resonate with what you're saying, because there is reasonable numbers within the at-large community that are also saying that, what, so we just, you know, go to court for everything. You know, if we don't go to court, then we spill the board. And I guess that's where the general community working group as a whole needs to take stock and see where they want to draw the lines in the sand.
Yeah.
But our stress tests, win, lose, or draw, are tools. And so they need to simply be able to be applied as hypothetical exercises to see where, in a spectrum of risk analysis, things may need to be shored up. We need to be aware that if they're not shored up, what might happen, and whether or not our proposed mechanisms and community powers, etc., are aiding or gaining or improving or shifting existing things. So I keep coming back to that because I think it is important. Avery, your hand's still up? Okay, back down. That was an old hand. Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I know Avery well enough now to know when she's being exasperated and satirical, and I know you were, and I know you were on purpose. So that's not going to work, Avery. We can't just throw up our hands and say, okay, great, everything goes to court. In fact, in the end, anything we say in community powers have to be enforceable. They have to be enforceable. I mean, Jonathan has it right in the chat. I mean, today's world, forgetting membership. In today's world, if I can't ignore the articles of incorporation or bylaws, quite frankly, the only solution is to sue them in court. And I don't even know who would sue them and under what grounds, but somebody could sue, go to the Attorney General of California in today's world, and a court would actually have to crack open the bylaws and read them. The court would have to drill into the action at hand and interpret the bylaws and make a decision. Thank God we haven't done that yet. That would be bad, but it would be the only way we could do it today. On the other hand, this changes everything. This new structure says that the members can get an independent review that is binding, get the decision, and if ICANN doesn't follow the decision, it can simply take that to a California court and said, here's a decision, enforce the decision. Don't review the decision. Don't read the bylaws to see whether the action fit the bylaws. Just enforce the IRP. And I'm told from Becky and others that any court around the world that respects independent arbitration results that were properly constructed will enforce the findings of an independent arbitrator. So if what makes you really uncomfortable is going down the line and saying in the end enforceability may require going to court, in the end enforceability may go, if that makes you uncomfortable, then you're just as uncomfortable today, and every one of our stress tests will make you uncomfortable because they all assume that the powers we have, blocking a bylaw, spilling the board, even spilling the board, ultimately won't work without the court behind you. Not that you went to court, but that everybody knows that if we voted to spill the board and the board would not leave, would continue to meet, continue to vote on things, you may have to go to court and say, get an injunction for these individuals to step down. We hope it never happens. Okay, Aubrey, you say you see it just the opposite. My goodness. Can you explain?
Yes. What we have now is a system where we don't go to court. It's not part of the system. Yes, it's ultimately there. Any American, anybody in the world can take anyone to court that they wish. That's part of the American system, and we see it happen all the time. But we have created a system at the moment, for better or for worse, and it doesn't rely on NTA as much as people think it does, but perhaps to some extent it does, although much less than I think people argue, where we butt our heads against each other and find compromise points. And we have built a multi-stakeholder process, and we've built these accountability loops where we judge them and they judge us, and this cyclical cross-internal accountability keeps happening. And we wanted to tone it up a little. We wanted to fix, you know, the reconsideration process, and we wanted to fix the basis on which one could do, you know, an independent panel review. And those things we've done. So it wasn't, I'm not arguing that it was perfect, so please don't. But at this point, court is not part of the fabric of what we do. It's the interplay, it's the reactions, it's the groups getting together and saying this is not what we want and something needs to be done. And that multi-stakeholder process that we keep refining and working on gets stronger and gets better through the cyclical reviews of each other, done in a very public, transparent way. What we have done now with these membership structures is we have created a very easy-to-use legal opening so that when things go wrong, what do you do? Do you continue to go through the hard process and the argument and the finding of consensus, or do you just say, hey, you know, let's just take it to court. That'll solve it. And so my belief is that what we're putting in actually makes the going to court far more likely. But as I said, that is not a stress test issue. The stress test works. We have a solution for every stressful situation. we could take it to court at the end if things are not working out right. I don't think anybody would have made that claim on the existing system. They would say, we'll argue it. We'll get together and we'll put together letters. We'll replace the bums the next time there's a cycle. That there's any number of processes and actions we would have taken. But going to court isn't one of them. Once we have put this in, and once we have put in the stress tests that show that anything can be fixed eventually by going to court, then the reasoning that starts to come in is, well, if I can go to court to fix it, why am I going to spend the next year butting my head against the wall? But even if I do spend the next year butting my head against the wall, you know, what am I doing? I'm building up evidence for my court case. So it really changes the emphasis of the system. It changes the direction of the system. And to my mind, makes it far less multi-stakeholder, but because it gives us an authority, as opposed to, you know, we pretend that the NTIA was this authority that was keeping ICANN in order. I don't really think so. I think that every N years when the contract was about to go up, you know, we cleaned ourselves up, put on our ties and dresses and stood there looking real pretty and accountable. But as a steady state factor in our multi-stakeholder processes, there was always not the, and I can call NTIA and they'll fix things for me, notion, because that wasn't the case. But now we do have this out, and just my personal belief is that acts as a foil to the multi-stakeholder processes. Thanks. But it's okay for the stress test team, because we've got a solution.
Thanks, Avery. I noticed Jonathan's hand's up, and hopefully he's properly connected now. Over to you, Jonathan.
Yes, can you hear me now?
Indeed we can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I guess this may just come down to a different crystal ball about what changes, will occur in people's mindset as a result of this framework. And that may be, it may be something we can't just debate our way out of. But it is certainly my understanding that there's a great deal of frustration among the community over the process that exists, because there weren't sufficient mechanisms for redress, there weren't specific ways to get things done, there weren't ways the review, the board reconsideration process was nothing short of a joke, and that was an issue of growing concern. And so you've actually had people going to governments more. You have people suing ICANN, et cetera, that the desire to go outside the ICANN process is something that I feel is percolating now. And I think that what we're doing with this framework is creating more mechanisms for redress and more authority for the community that's ultimately backed by a court, and makes it mandatory that you actually go through these processes before you actually get to a court. And so, in that sense, there's less, I think, incentive to go to a court willy-nilly, because the court doesn't have the jurisdiction, in most cases, to deal with the substantive issues that are at hand. The only thing that they would have the jurisdiction to decide is whether or not the processes that we're putting in place had been adhered to. So that would create a narrowing of focus of courts, which courts like, by the way, and a focus on these processes as the ultimate arbiters of the substance of the issues. And so I think, Aubrey, I'm completely with you and supportive of the hard work that we do to get these things resolved within the community. I do think that there's a growing frustration that after doing all the hard work, that the board does something else. And so fundamentally changing the ultimate authority, if you will, to the community is the objective of these measures, and the court are simply a means of enforcement of that authority not the arbiters of the questions that we have at hand. So I think that's fundamentally where the difference of opinion or misunderstanding lies is the ways that we'd be able to go to court. The real way to go to court would be to say, look, we went through this whole process and they still ignored it. Please enforce this. It's very different than they made this decision, I disagree with it, come and play the role of Solomon and arbitrate this decision. And I think that our likelihood of doing that now is much greater than it is with these new accountability mechanisms that we're trying to put in place.
Have we lost you, Steve?
Nope, I'm here.
Oh, good. I just heard a clunk. Was that you, Jonathan?
I definitely heard a clunk, though.
I don't know if I clunked or not, right?
Okay.
I'm hoping my ideas took wing and that they didn't clunk, but you guys will have to.
Take flight, not crash and burn. Okay. Steve, over to you.
Yeah, there's four of us most significantly engaging in this conversation, and I think we are ships passing in the night. We're not even on the same body of water because it is so clear to Jonathan and I that you don't go to court. You go to the IRP, and only if you followed all those rules and processes. And there's even this notion that you don't even get to do an IRP if you didn't participate in the public comment process, if one was held on the particular issue. And that notion came from Google, who put it into the business constituency comments that I'll be filing in a few hours. And the BC supported this idea that you shouldn't even be able to sit on the sidelines and wait till the decision was made and then file an IRP. It'd be crazy. So we're trying to really say everything happens within the IRP. And the stress tests, I'm going to check, but my belief is that the word court doesn't appear anywhere in the stress test as part of the solution. Instead, it says that these powers of the community, we assume that these community powers are enforceable. And if somebody said, well, how do you enforce that? This is the question Aubrey put to us with regard to Section 2 of the UA articles. How do you enforce that? Well, the answer to how do you enforce that is always going to end up in court. It's a legal relationship between shareholders in a corporation, between members in an organization, between voters and elected officials. Eventually, you go to court if you can't get satisfaction. If they don't just sort of listen, everybody understands the court can force the action to happen. So if in the final result, it could go to court to be enforced, if that gives you guys pause, well, then nothing we're doing makes it worse than the fears you must have today. But, Cheryl, you indicated, agree with you, Aubrey, and I'm still wondering, what is it you say that you agree with Aubrey on? Thanks.
Right, coming off mute. I think I'm off mute now. The concern of that Aubrey's articulated is resonating across a number of the members of our community, where the question of do we actually need to have a I'm going to go into metaphor world now here, so apologies in advance. A belt, a braces, a catching net, and a tether rope approach to everything? Or are we setting up a set of systems that really mean if in doubt, spill the board or go to court to see if they will or won't change their minds and agree with the wider community, and if they don't or they're recalcitrant, spill the board, in which case, why don't we just make sure that we have properly articulated and reasonably reinforced mechanisms that allow and fastly process methods of filling the board as required. I also feel that, and this is beyond the, I agree with you, Avery, a number of the people I've been talking to within our community are concerned that in some cases all we're doing is shifting where the transparency focus is, where the critical control points for transparency is. And that might be okay, Steve. Don't get me wrong. It's an observation, not necessarily a criticism. And I think that's where we do need to bring the wider community along with us in these stress test scenarios in the not too distant future. Steve, I know you said that the slides on the screen show the members do not get to go to court to challenge the board. Well, they do, of course, if they can show that they've been materially harmed. And I had a long conversation today with someone from the CCNSO community who was concerned about the possibility of putting a scenario forward for our consideration which would test the hypothetical of release of two-letter technically country codes, but into GTLD world, and whether or not the member that would be representing the CCNSO in such a scenario in our future model would in fact have standing to go through the challenge and the IRP processes to say that a board decision to release those two codes in fact has resulted in material harm or the potential for material harm for the entity which they represent. And I think these are conversations that we do have to have and stress tests that we may indeed have to pursue. But I see Jonathan's hand back up. Jonathan, over to you.
Old hand, sorry.
Well, we know you're an old hand, Jonathan, but you're always welcome to leave it up. You usually have something to fill in anyway. Steve, back to you.
Thanks, Cheryl. Slide four, if you please scroll to slide four. This isn't a tie-off as much as Becky trying to respond to what might be a misconception. This notion that creating the member structure suddenly empowers people to go to court more so than they could today. But even so, there's a tie-off, and that's what slide four is supposed to be. And the key question here was, can we avoid having a California court resolve a substantive dispute with ICANN members, to your example in the CCNSO, an aggrieved party? And if the aggrieved party is one of the ACs and SOs, then their rights to sue are limited, and the bylaws can suggest that they have to go to IRP. The form in which claims are brought, the fourth bullet on this slide. So if it's an ACNSO, there's nothing about membership structure that will increase the likelihood you're in court. In fact, it forces you to do the IRP. An IRP, if it ever ends up in court, it's only to enforce what the IRP came up with, and that it's extremely transparent. The panel itself is individuals that the community approved or recommended. I've forgotten which of the two it was. And they're supposed to be experienced people that are paid to be on standby to be available for an IRP whenever we need it. So the beginning of your scenario started with this notion that an aggrieved party is going to run to court, but we're not creating a structure that makes that more likely than it is today. And Jonathan suggested less likely. So, I mean, the stress test, if we had one, would say something like aggrieved parties in the community abuse the new member structure and community powers. And we have one of those, but maybe we could expand it to indicate that they can't abuse these powers by going to court. If we suggest that if the bylaws suggest that IRP is the avenue of disputes about the board's actions or inactions with respect to the bylaws. Yeah, we had talked about, there is one stress test that talks about number 13, it's on page 81, which is one or several stakeholders excessive rely on accountability mechanism to paralyze ICANN.
Yeah.
And again, it doesn't speak at all to courts. It just talks about redress mechanisms more accessible. So this might be a new one, this notion of courts. Nobody's trying to run away from this. We're trying to take it head on.
Absolutely.
In first instance, we're saying, I'm sorry, nothing we're doing is making your fears more realizable than the current situation. And that's not a tie-off. That's a clarification. Mm-hmm. You may still discover that you have concerns that require a tie-off, and we may have to come up with one. But so far, I feel like we're mostly rebutting some fears and uncertainties by clarifying, like we did with Chris's case at the beginning of this call, and like I think slide 4 does with respect to this notion that aggrieved parties just run to court. I don't see it. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. I'm very aware of the hour and looking towards us just having a couple of minutes more on the call. Do you want to take an action item then to expand on that stress test 13 to have a subset or additional one which does speak about the specificity of using the IRP, not the court pathway? That's a very clumsy way of trying to articulate what you just said, Steve, so I apologize.
Yeah, sure. No, I'll do that. So there's two to-dos for me today. One was Matthew on the FIFA scandal, and then the other one is to drop. Expand on 13. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And
thanks.
To that, if we could have those that draft out to us as the work party list, and then send to the wider list for feedback before our next call, I think that would be a good way forward.
I agree with that, and that is what I did last week. When I sent it to this list, I heard crickets except for Jonathan Zook, and then I waited 24 hours and sent it to the list. I'll do the same thing this time.
I think that's a good precedent to follow. And we will have a full, frank, and fearless discussion, hopefully with some more people involved,
Well, you know what? I didn't mind.
So it doesn't matter. And can I say, can you all hear how loud my dog is snoring?
Yeah.
I can barely hear over it. But I have little choice. I'm surrounded by three very elderly dogs in the lounge room. So my apologies.
Yeah, there were a few calls earlier on in February, I think, where we heard them snoring at the beginning of the call. I couldn't believe it.
What can I say? I live in an aging community. There's a whole bunch of bitches here.
Hey, Cheryl, I too regret there weren't more people on the call, but I don't mind at all having the discussion like this and the debate. I mean, that you guys are airing concerns, and then we're getting a chance to push back and explore them better.
Well, Steve, I think also, Cheryl, for the record again, when you're hearing, you know, Cheryl saying, Avery saying, we're not just representing our own, you know, internal turmoils and concerns here. We're reflecting what we're hearing from the communities that we're talking to as well, and these things have to be worked through. And after all, that's really the basis of what a stress test working party is all about. Mm-hmm. So. I'm happy with our progress to date, but we do need to decide what we're doing after this time next week, and I would suggest we have a hiatus we'll do our call next week, but the following week we will find many of our members are starting to travel. And so I think we should advance now that we won't be holding a call in the week of the, is it the 15th or 13th or 12th or 11th or whatever date it is. I'm sure Kimberly and Brenda and everyone will sort that out quite effectively. Adam, you've waved your hand. You probably have the answer to my question here.
Can you hear me?
We can indeed.
Sometimes my computer mic is quite useless. Anyway, I just wanted to know, do you anticipate needing any series of calls in response to the public comment, or are you just going to stick to the current schedule as you just described? Because we do want to start scheduling up all of the intense sort of work of calls that will be needed after public comment. Thoughts on that would be great. Thanks.
Okay. I think we'll cover that in a little more detail in next week's call, Adam, but my initial reaction is we have powered on with an existing schedule and probably will still continue to power on with an existing schedule, cancelling the odd meeting when there is insufficient critical mass of information or people to do anything with. Alice tells me it's the week of June 17th that we will not be holding a call. Thank you, Alice. It's good to have the voice of sanity and calendar accuracy in all of this. So, Adam, I would suggest that at this stage we will just be doing our weekly calls as is.
Cheryl, question?
Please go ahead, Steve.
When staff pulls together all the comments that will flood in today, there's two questions, I guess. Who will go through them and find all the news, any implications for stress tests? Sometimes they're not new. There'll be implications to modify a stress test. But we need to go through all the comments to see if people have mentioned something that suggests or directly implicates a stress test. And then this group has to get on the phone and talk through how we want to react to the public comments.
Yeah.
Do you think that would happen as soon as next Wednesday, or does it happen the week after?
I doubt we will be doing that in the next Wednesday. I think we'll probably be doing that in the post-CA period. We would be using, I would have predicted, the pro forma tool that has been used in other cross-community working groups and allows us to show that we have discussed, considered, and responded to particular public comments that come in. Now, Adam, hand up. Heavens above, it's not an old hand. You're chatting at me as well. Go ahead, Adam. We can't hear you, Adam. We see your microphone attempting to talk to us, but no voice coming through. Okay, whilst Adam is typing, I'll note that Alice has picked out that, yes, there are stress test-related comments. I must say, in the CWG, staff had been worth their weight in gold in identifying the particular parts of CWG work that were relating to each of the comments, and they ended up with a colour-coded tool which indicated what design team or teams needed to consider and respond the specifics from public comments. And I perhaps am living in a utopia, but was rather hopeful that we would get the same kind care and consideration and support in our endeavours as well. Okay, Adam is saying you will see the compilation of those stress test responses in the PC tool. Okay, so it looks to me like Adam is saying that the way that the PC tool has been used in the CWG work is going to be emulated to some extent, if not exactly, in our work as well. So, Steve, that means that we should have readily identified the particular public comments that we need to address, and we will then make it the business of one or two or more meetings, as the design teams have in the CWG in the recent 10 or so days, to address each of those issues in our meetings in a transparent manner. Adam, is there anything else you want to type at us or try and say? No, he's all good. Okay. All right. Well, gremlins considered, and the cacophony of my aging, what do I call them? I guess I'll call them the chorus in the room with me tonight, who I trust can be forgiven. Let's call it a day for this call. We will meet again same time next week, but we will be not meeting in the following meet, which is the week of the 17th of June, as most of us, if not all of us, will be travelling. Thank you, one and all. Don't forget, respond if you wish to respond, and I encourage you to do so, on the list to the couple of new scenarios that Steve will be putting forward. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, staff. And thank you very much, one and all, for joining the call. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Bye.